there. It's Carmen Wong Ulrich, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of November 29th, 2013. This show is about you, how to maximize the choices that you make every day, big and small. Now, that means getting the most value out of every decision, financially and personally. This week in How We Live Money, our first financial lessons come from our families. And many family holiday traditions, well, you know, they carry a very big cost, like shopping for gifts. It's a critical time for retailers. They want your money. And many make nearly half of their income during the winter holidays. Now, so much is at stake. So stores, online and off, are using a new edge to nudge you into spending more. Data. Retailers are now following your every move. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith is here to give us the scoop on Retailer Snoop. Hi, Stacey.
Hi, Carmen.
Thanks for joining us. You know, data can be a very scary thing, but explain a little bit about how our data is being used to boost sales in retail.
You may notice sometimes ads will follow you around from site to site, right?
I notice that and it freaks me out.
Yes. If you're looking at a pair of boots on Zappos or something, you may notice when you go onto Facebook, the pair of boots you were looking at shows up.
They follow you.
Yes, they follow you. And that is because retailers are planting cookies on our browser, and then they buy ad space on places that you frequent and the ads show up.
Now, talk about dynamic pricing. And this is very antithesis to kind of old school behavioral economics in terms of, okay, how much am I going to charge you for something versus I'm going to charge this other guy something else because it's a different person. That is very different.
Yes. In fact, Amazon got into a whole lot of trouble a couple of years ago for doing just that. People figured out that they were charging different prices for a DVD to different people. So stores are being very cautious about that right now because they know that that is part of their reputation. What we are seeing a lot of is dynamic pricing linked to timing. Last year, Marketplace tracked a Star Wars DVD box set with the help of a site called Camel Camel Camel. And the price fluctuated from $134 on Black Friday. It peaked there. And it fell to $70 a few days after Black Friday. Huge price difference.
And the backlash really is based on the idea of being fair and
oh,
equal,
yeah.
Which a lot of people want to be seen as being fair and equal, that I'm getting the same price on something as the next guy. However, pricing in terms of timing doesn't seem as exploitive. What is the technology and the data that in-store retailers are using?
Well, there are a lot of different kinds. Right now, what's being used are a lot of so-called smart cameras. They'll track customer movements around a store. They'll see where customers tend to go, where the foot traffic flow goes, and they figure out kind of where to place things. And stores like Crabtree and Evelyn and Adidas have used this to increase customer spending by 5%, which
and
is huge.
Grocery stores have been using that for years.
Yes, exactly. And they're kind of taking that to the next level a little bit with some big data technology that gets a little frightening, at least in my opinion. One is facial recognition software.
Wow.
Which is being used, you know, on Facebook sometimes it'll be able to kind of guess who a photo is of. So they will eventually, perhaps, be able to tell who we are by our faces.
What can they possibly do to get you to spend money in the store after they know that you're there?
If you have a history with the store, then they know what you tend to buy, how much you tend to spend. I spoke with Joseph Tureau about this. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication, and he wrote a book called The Daily You, How the New Advertising Industry is Defining Your Identity and Your Worth. Here's what he had to say.
We will have people being put into what I call reputation silos, which would tell the store this person is more likely to buy the cheap stuff, and here's the person who buys the premium stuff. The goal is to change the store for the individual and change the prices as they move through the store.
The idea eventually is that our trip through a brick and mortar store will be personalized and tailored to us the way our trip to a website would be.
How can someone protect themselves from identity theft or from these stores getting all this information on them?
Well, there are a couple different ways. The first is online. It's a little more simpler. You can use search engines like DuckDuckGo. That's an anonymous search engine. It doesn't track you like Google does.
Wow.
There are also services like Ghostery is one of them. And if you sign up for that, they will show you who's tracking you on each site. And you can also block the tracking.
Well, then the flip side of that as well is we know that there's technology that will send coupons to your phone
right
once you walk in.
yeah. to a store. So there is some utility for the consumer here. It's not just
Absolutely.
Predicting maybe what you buy, but possibly saving you money. So, but at what price, Stacey?
Well, it is very convenient for consumers. Suddenly you're getting ads that are relevant to you for things you might want to buy. So there is something that you are getting. You're getting coupons when you walk into a store that might save you money that you're interested in, much more so than just the circular that you would normally get when you walked into a supermarket. There is this advantage, and I think that is what we're dealing with in all cases, big data. The customer gets something in exchange for their information.
Stacey Vanek-Smith joined us today talking about big data and our shopping on Black Friday. Stacey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Carmen.
We'll have those sites that Stacey mentioned at marketplacemoney.org. And tell us, are you okay with what retailers are up to all up in your biz? Tweet at Live Money. You know, there's a really big difference between your kids getting $20 from grandma in their holiday card and giving a gift that can't be touched until they retire. And that's our first listener call for today.
Carmen.
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 Carmen, what's going on?
We've got Tina. She's from Pomfret, Connecticut, and she has a very grown-up gift in mind for her 19-year-old daughter. Welcome, Tina.
Thank you.
Okay, so tell me, what do you want to do for your daughter?
We normally give her Christmas presents, but then it ends up being in our donation pile. She's 19, and I'm thinking of helping her set up her future retirement fund. She recently got a full-time job, and I want to help her get maybe a IRA account started, and how should I go about that?
Well, first, you know, before I ask about her, I have to ask about you and your retirement, because one of the things that we always want to make sure when we're planning for our kids is to do the whole oxygen mask on you first and then on them so that you don't become a burden to them. So what does your retirement look like and your husband's?
We max out our 401k and we work for the same employer. We're getting back on track to what it should be.
Oh, what happened?
We trusted family for a while and kind of helped them out, and we were expecting to get payment back, but that never happens.
Ah, see, that is the key.
When
helping out family members, just remember it's always a gift.
Yeah, exactly. Well, now we know. We learned the hard way.
Okay. So then now we can talk about your daughter and her future. And you said she's 19, and mm-hmm. she's right now at community college. Is she eventually going to go into a four-year?
That's what she wants to do, but she doesn't know what. She doesn't know what mm-hmm. she wants to do. It's understandable at her age. She might transfer to the UConn near us and continue there when she decides what she wants to go pursue.
Oh, Tina, that is so smart, by the way. That was so smart to do the community college while you're figuring out what you want to do. But how are you guys going to plan on paying for her college when she goes to 4-year?
Well, we're going to have her take out the loan. And we'll try to help her in whatever way we can.
Now, you're saying, so you want to open a retirement account for her?
Yes.
Why retirement rather than just savings?
I just want her to have something further down the road, not just immediate future. She has a savings, and I also want her to contribute into the retirement because of the compound interest. I wish that somebody had told me about this when I was in my teens or 20s. I just put that money aside and not touch it. I think I would have been rich by now.
A lot of us would have been rich, but we probably had a lot of expenses too. So with your question about wanting to save for her, there are two scenarios and potential costs. You could put it in retirement for her, but then she'd take out student loans and that would cost her money that she could be saving. So she'd be starting out a little behind. Or you could put it in an account. Maybe you don't necessarily tell her yet about this account. You don't have to. For if she goes to a 4-year school, so she doesn't have to take out loans.
Okay.
And in that way, she could put more of her paycheck towards saving for retirement instead of paying those student loan bills.
What would that account be? Is that the education?
It could be in a 529, though I definitely recommend not, because she's too close to needing that money and you can't afford to risk anything.
Right.
So if it's in a retirement account and retirement's way off, it makes a lot of sense. One other thing is that, is she a full-time student or is she working full-time?
She's working full-time now.
Well, one thing that you might want to consider for her, and I would have to check, and I will follow up with you online, about the Roth IRA. Because a Roth IRA under her, you the two of you as a couple make too much money, but she doesn't. And she falls under the income guidelines. And she could have a Roth IRA that you contribute to. So it's money that's for retirement. Or after 5 years, she can use the principal, the original amount that you put into the Roth, and she can use that and take it out without penalty.
Okay.
So that could be used for, let's say, something more short term, paying off student loans, because this is like the cycle of the young folks, paying off student loans and then or retirement.
Okay, so I think the Roth might be the path that we will look into further.
Just in case.
Yeah.
And it's hard because we want our kids to know more of the value of money and to plan a little better. And you mentioned that she may be a little bit more of a spender than you are.
Yes, she is. But, you know, they're young and she's always browsing online and shopping for things that she doesn't need or can't even afford. I can't even afford, but she just likes to look. So far, there's no action yet, so I guess it's good. But
aha, exactly. But here's one thing. I want to give you a little assignment here for the two of you as mother and daughter to work on together. You mentioned the power of compound interest. It's great if you can show her that power. There's a really nerdy website that I love that's free called dinkytown.net. And it has every financial calculator you could possibly need, pretty much. And you can go on there and there's just a straightforward compound interest calculator. Let's say we put $200 a month and, you know, for the next 20 years at 5%. And see how much you'll have. It could really blow her mind because I think people really need to actually see that in action to see how powerful it is.
That's great. I just wish I had known about this when I was 20. I would have been way better off right now.
All right. It's mother-daughter time with financial calculators.
Yes. Yes, definitely. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tina. And if you have a question for me, want to hear more about those websites, head over to marketplacemoney.org. Coming up, easing the financial stress of the holidays.
Family. It's that time of year. buying gifts and putting on dinners and all that, it can be pretty financially straining sometimes.
Well, if I can give you one gift for the holidays, it's tools on how to cope and enjoy. That's next on Marketplace Money from APM. We love our families. We do. Though they may be a handful this time of year. But sometimes we hide things from them, particularly things to do with money. Now, whether we do it out of shame or a desire for autonomy, or even as a tool to control those people around us, money secrets can be toxic. But it can help to know why you or someone you love keeps those secrets in the first place. Here to help us dig deeper is Dr. Gail Saltz. She's a psychiatrist and author of several books, including the very appropriate The Anatomy of a Secret Life, The Psychology of Living a Lie. And her specialty is relationships. Welcome to Marketplace Money, Gail.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Now, we've got Catherine on the line, and she has a very, very interesting situation that caused a lot of trouble. Catherine. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Catherine, explain a little bit about what happened with your parents and how it's affected you.
So I grew up mostly with a single mom because when I was about 7 years old, my parents divorced. And, you know, I grew up and things were financially pretty tough because my mom was raising three kids on her own and really without any additional assistance from my father from that point on. And as I got older and started to really question that, what I found out is that they divorced and there was so much financial hardship afterwards because he actually had lost his job and had not told her and had managed the finances as if he was still earning a paycheck and put everything on credit and really kind of brought everything crashing down after a number of months ran out and it just couldn't be sustained anymore.
How long was this able to go on? Just a couple of months?
About 6 months.
And how were the bills sustained? Was this all on credit?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you just find this out or did you know this as it happened?
Oh, I definitely did not know it as it happened. My mom was really, really protective for good reason of her young kids. I was the oldest and the youngest at the time was less than a year old. I found out as I got older and both wanted to understand more about how to manage money and was curious about money and like why we didn't use credit cards as a family, things like that. And also just curiosity about, okay, well, life is pretty different now. What changed and what happened. So it was really something that she tried to share with me in a, age-appropriate way as I got older.
So you were raised with certain financial, shall we say, dogmas that you were curious about, like the idea that credit is a very bad thing to have.
Right, or that credit cards are really something that you should avoid if there's any alternative to them.
So, Gail, this is such a big deal. You have to kind of sit there and just soak this in. For Catherine to find this out, can you explain a little bit about why would someone, meaning her father, do that?
This is actually less uncommon than you would imagine. And I heard a lot about this during the recession when a lot of people lost their jobs. For many men, employment, equals identity, equals masculinity, equals power and control in the world. And the shame of losing your job, of getting fired, is too much. And to lose face, as it were, with your family feels like it would be, annihilating, really. And so, unfortunately, handling it by pretending it's not happening, which is, an extreme form of denial, is an unfortunate and pathological method of dealing, but it is something that men do. They've done over the decades. I mean, you could go back and hear this story from various decades of the 1900s. It's the denial, the compartmentalizing. Well, my family will still respect me, and sort of telling themselves, and I'll get it back. I'll get something back, and so on, and not accepting the fact that in a certain way they're destroying. It's self-destructive, and they're destroying their family in the meanwhile. But it bespeaks sort of a weakness, a loss of self-esteem, and a fear of not being loved or valued. So in a way, we could say we feel sorry for him. But at the same time, Catherine, obviously, it's terrible, how that left you and how it left your mother. But I think it's very useful to understand the secrets that form all these sort of what seem like arbitrary rules in the world, right? So that you can take it out in the light of day and examine it and decide what realistically makes sense for you going forward and for you, and for the family you would build, whether, it's based on something that really was some pathology of a parent.
So, Catherine, how has this shaped you beyond, let's say, the credit card, that those kind of lessons that you've learned, how having, and learning about this financial secret, how has it shaped your approach to how you manage your money and, in future, maybe with your own family?
I think the biggest influence has been that I really took to heart the idea that you need to be ready to be financially independent at any time. And sometimes it's because people do something that really lets you down, but sometimes it's something that is out of everyone's control. Or, other people have their spouse die and have to suddenly pick up and be financially independent. And that really, from the age that I was legally allowed, I was working jobs so that I was able to have control over my own money as opposed to, relying on my mom. And there was also a factor of like wanting to be helpful and not be a burden, but just the impact of having control over the money that I could earn was powerful to me even at the age of 13 and 14. But then when my now wife and I moved in together for the first time several years ago, combining finances was really hard for me to figure out what I was comfortable with and what was realistic and how to really build a trusting and transparent relationship around finances as a couple. That was tough.
That makes complete sense because, of course, you had, in a way, right, the supreme betrayal. And so anybody who's been incredibly betrayed, especially as a child, often has difficulty in trusting, right, that someone's not going to betray them again. And even if you could love your wife, you know, and think she's the best and you really, you know, you should trust her. But these are like deep-seated, you know, not conscious things. And so your awareness of that is the first step. I think being able to talk to and explain to your partner that you, of course, you trust her as much as you could trust anyone, but that this is a vulnerable issue for you because of the betrayal that you've had. And I think that it's okay to have some boundaries. The question becomes, when does it become pathological for you? So if you're living in fear all the time, then that's a problem. If you're unable to trust anyone to do sort of reasonable things, then that's a problem. Having some boundaries, like you said, the lessons you learned about being independent, well, that's actually a healthy coping
tool. Well,
that's a tool.
Yeah. I actually think that's the best lesson. Catherine, I had a similar, though not exactly the same, but upbringing and job loss in my family with my father. And one of the things that it did affect me was that I wanted to be financially independent as soon as possible. And part of that, too, does deal with trust. But Catherine, so, you know, I advise folks that if you're, you know, getting married or you're living together, that you can have a household account for household bills, but you should always have your own money and your own credit. Catherine, how are you guys working out the household bills right now?
We actually, that's exactly what we do. When we first started combining finances, we had a joint checking account that was just getting the bare minimum into it to pay for truly joint expenses like our grocery bills and utilities and rent. And over time, what we've done is kind of shift that balance slowly as we've felt comfortable with it. Now the majority of each of our paychecks goes into our joint checking account, and we each keep money on the side that we can use for, you know, personal hobbies, expenses that we don't feel like it would be fair to ask the other one to help with. For me, a lot of times that includes clothes. I buy more clothes than my wife does.
But it sounds like you talk about it. It sounds like you talk about it. And that's very healthy and functional, that if you're sitting down and sort of making it, you know, now we're going to move to this. And here's my logic. Here's where I'm coming from. You know, if you were calling and saying, you know, my wife feels like I don't trust her, or, you know, this is causing fights, or we just actually never talk about it, or I don't know what to do because we're not having the next step conversation, that would be a problem. But actually, it sounds
that's a
very reasonable way of handling
it. It sounds like, Catherine, what you've taken from this is kind of similar to what I took from it, which is you want your autonomy. And yeah, there's some trust there. But I get the sense, Catherine, that you feel a little bit guilty about not trusting. Do you feel like you have to trust your wife implicitly, or that there's something wrong with how things are right now? Does she pressure you at all?
I don't feel like there's anything wrong right now. But I do feel like, yes, you absolutely do need to be able to trust your spouse implicitly around money. And that requires talking about it a lot.
Well, actually, there's the word implicit.
Right, right. So, Gail saw me cringe when that.
Yeah. But you know what? So I think that you do need to have a good amount of trust to have real intimacy, to not feel like it's me against you, but we're like in this together. But I also think that it's okay to have a modicum of whatever would happen in this world. Like, look, you know, you could get hit by a bus tomorrow. So could your wife. I mean, have a modicum of, I need to be able to take care of myself. So this I keep to know that I can do that, which I don't think is the same as not trusting.
Right.
Just knowing that you have to trust in yourself as well.
It's a thing of, and a lot of folks say, well, if you really trust each other, you should combine your finances. There are many financial reasons why you should not be fully combined. So, for example, you should always have credit in your own name, because when you get married, you don't share credit. You don't share credit reports. You don't share credit scores, credit history. And you should always have some cash in your name just in case, God forbid, anything happens to your spouse or partner and you don't have access for any reason to certain funds, that you always have your own. And to me, it's not a matter so much of trust as you've got to be able to, as much as you love each other, be able to live on your own just in case.
Yeah, it's the old, you know, put your oxygen mask on
yes,
first, and then you can help, you know, the loved one. It sounds to me like maybe there's still some feeling of people can let you down in this huge way, unbeknownst to you.
Scary way.
Scary, behind your back, and just having that fear in the world, you know, can make you doubt yourself as you make decisions along the way.
Catherine, can I ask you, your relationship with your mom, you know, once she revealed this to you, did anything change?
In a lot of ways, I saw my mom for a long time as a superhero, just that she was able to take this incredible moment of crisis and not just like limp along and survive, but actually really rebuild security and make sure that she provided what we needed to be successful financially and as adults, you know, following whatever it was that each of us has wanted to pursue.
Your mom sounds awesome. Actually,
she is.
She sounds pretty darn awesome. Give our regards to your mom for us. And thank you so much, Catherine from Maryland, for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Now, you know, Gail, of course, this is the holiday season and this is a bunch of family time. So we went to the streets of D.C. to ask some folks about what they're looking forward to or not about the holiday season and their family.
The holidays bring about a huge financial pressure for my family and my boyfriend's daughter, who is obviously part of our family, always wants specific things. And we try to reiterate the value of the holidays and what they mean. They're about family. They're about love and enjoying the peaceful nature of people and humanity.
It's that time of year.
It's expensive to fly back from the East Coast to the West Coast and just buying gifts and putting on dinners and all that. It can be pretty financially straining sometimes. I'm actually not going home this year, so I decided earlier that I just didn't have it in my finances to fly home and take the time off of work, and so I'm not.
Well, you can't please everybody, can you, this time of year? And we got KD wrote into us and said, "We told my wife's family a year after our son was born that nobody over a certain age would receive a gift from us. Well, that didn't sit well. My mother-in-law being the most vocal. Oh, well, we haven't backed off one bit." Gail, this time of year, there's a lot of choosing in terms of finances, whether it's gifts or, like we just heard, making the trip. And some people just don't think it's good of us to do that.
You know, because some people feel that the gift represents the love, right? Like, I picked something out and so on, and I'm giving you some love. So I think if you keep that in mind and you find either another way to demonstrate very outwardly the love, maybe it is a beautiful note that you wrote about your feelings for that person. Maybe it's something you baked, because food often can substitute and represent love. And also a discussion with it that, you know, these are the realities. It doesn't mean I love you less if I can't spend more. And try to show the person that really, that this is not about a measure of your love. I think this is the kerosene on the holidays for people, that when you bring family together, everybody has overly high expectations. They measure how well the relationships are going by this one gathering that is so stressful. And if everybody could take it down a notch and have other conversations, not put so many eggs in this one holiday basket, not overemphasize what it means, and find other ways of expressing not only their love, but their gratitude. One thing I tell people to do over the holidays is, at the end of the day, sit down and write to yourself three things that you just feel grateful for today. And they could be things like, that was a wonderful cup of tea I had, or I loved my conversation with Uncle Joe, or whatever
it
is.
Focusing on the positive, and the positive that doesn't necessarily cost money, because the thing is that we hear so much about so many folks, and I know that we've had a caller on the show who spent thousands of dollars, even though they were tens of thousands of dollars in debt, on gifts because of guilt and
That's
expectation.
Right.
How do you be strong in that moment and say, okay, I value something else? Or maybe you don't say that, you just are aware of it, and you have to be able to not fall prey to guilt and then end up in debt.
Sometimes people have, when they're angry, and they often feel angry after they're made to feel guilty, right? Mm-hmm. That makes you angry. They have trouble expressing their positive feelings. And then they give a gift to get rid of the guilt, to not have to say something nice.
Right, to avoid.
Just here, you know?
Avoid all
so
confirmation.
So I think that propels a lot of people to get more out of guilt, out of, I don't want to say I love you. So if you could take a beat and say, am I giving this gift because A, I have the money to do it and it's okay, because I believe it will bring me pleasure and them pleasure, or is this a guilt gift? Mm-hmm. And am I having trouble saying something positive? So if you can take that beat, be honest with yourself, and then it's okay to write something positive, to say something positive, and to do something within your means.
Exactly. I mean, that is the key. And, you know, I've always said, don't do things out of guilt. It's one of the worst reasons to do things. And when this first time I heard that, it was like, I mean, listen, I was raised Catholic. So, you know, guilt is, you know, we've got
Jew,
we've got all
I'm
of
sorry.
That.
I think we have the market here, but okay.
We share that in common, okay? So this whole guilt thing. But once you realize that it's not a good reason to do something.
Well, not only that, but it's a vicious cycle,
it
right?
Is.
Because then you are feeling more stressed out, more angry, as if the other person forced you to spend the money, right? And then it repeats itself.
And then you know what? You end up with the bill. Dr. Gail Saltz is the author of The Anatomy of a Secret Life, The Psychology of Living a Lie. Thank you so much for joining us.
It is my pleasure. Have a happy holiday.
And if you have a question about family and money, tweet me anytime at Live Money or find us at marketplacemoney.org and click on Ask Carmen. Now, while you're there, check out the blogs on family, finances, and money secrets. Next, a lead singer shares his family's lyrics about money.
When I was a kid, we never spent money. We spent our time playing pickup basketball. There wasn't the consumerism that there is today. It would never have crossed our mind, for instance, to go hang out at the mall.
Plus, teaching financial literacy in schools. Now, who would be against that? Well, some say it gets an F. That's coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. Now, many of us are going to be on a little bit of a credit card swiping frenzy for the holidays. But what if you don't have credit?
Carmen, what's going on?
Well, it's time to take another call from you. And this one is about doing very well earning money in your career, but being very far behind when it comes to credit. Now, William is 71. He's a successful retired pediatrician, and he joins us from West Virginia. Now, William made the family money all those years, but his wife got all the credit, literally. So, William, now that you're done earning all that money, you found out that you don't really seem to exist.
Apparently, I don't exist at all, which is a little chagrining.
Tell me about that. How did that happen?
My wife and I actually had friends who were reasonably well off, and the wife got in trouble by not having a credit rating while the husband did. In the beginning of women's liberation, all we thought we would try and do something about that. So it's ended up that I have one credit card in my name with a $4,000 limit, and my wife has perhaps five credit cards, and I find it a little annoying to find that I don't have a credit and she does. It seems as if there might possibly be something we could do to share the credit rating like we tried to share the decisions from the beginning.
What led you to discover that you're kind of incognito in the credit space?
We were trying to see whether I should apply for an increase in the credit limit. And the first thing we did was to check the free credit reports for my wife, which came out excellent, and for me, and I didn't seem to exist. We wondered whether there was some advice about what we might do.
And when you say you use your wife's credit card, is her name on the card?
No, it's my name on the card. You know, all the paperwork comes through as if she's the primary account holder.
Right, because actually she probably is, and you're probably an authorized user.
Exactly.
And the interesting thing about authorized user status is that with the credit reporting agencies, for the most part, some of them don't consider that in part of building your credit.
Right.
And here's the thing, though, because you really raise a big point when it comes to credit. Credit now is so much a part of your identity. It gives you autonomy. So having credit and existing in the whole credit system is really kind of like your adult report card. And if you don't use credit or you don't have credit in your name, it's almost as if you're just not there.
Yeah, and I also wondered what would happen if my wife became incapacitated and suddenly all the credit records, you know, had been in her name and weren't accessible for what I would need to do.
Here's the thing. You mentioned, and you say we a lot. So I take it that, you know, the two of you are very connected, not just, of course, being together and married couple, but financially. You feel like you share a lot.
Absolutely.
Interestingly enough, William, when it comes to credit, we don't share anything. Unless it's a joint card or a joint debt. Let's say if you had the mortgage in both your names, that sort of that builds credit. I wonder, what's your wife's take on this? Is she amused or is she annoyed like you are?
She wants to know whether you're amused or annoyed, Elizabeth. She's shrugging. Probably a little amused.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, this is the point where she's like, well, you know, I'm good.
Yep.
How much do you feel, because you're retired, because you're in an interesting kind of situation, you're not necessarily making any big purchases right now. Why do you need to build credit, I'm wondering?
I'm not sure what implications this will have, but we're thinking about moving to a continuing care retirement community, and I'm not sure whether our need for credit in that new environment would be different.
Yeah, a lot of it's going to depend on your lifestyle. It will make a difference. I mean, usually when you move into those communities, they do a credit check. It's interesting that you're thinking about that. So one of the things that you can do is you have one open card. I would open up another card and make sure, because I don't want you incurring any balances. Do you guys carry any credit card debt?
No, we don't have any debt. We're lucky.
Oh, that's amazing. And that's where everybody wants to be in retirement. But to build your credit, and this sounds very counterintuitive because folks are like, well, I don't want another credit card. Get another card.
Okay.
Rotate the two cards in your wallet. One card, I call it, could be your G card, gas or groceries. The other card could be to pay for something as simple as a subscription. And the cards, just the fact that you're using them, that you pay in full every month over time, will build your credit.
Uh-huh.
And so instead of spending on your wife's card, try to get in the habit of spending on your own and just make sure that she has you there as an authorized user. She may be able to call up, though, one of her credit card companies and say, my husband and I would like to open a joint card. So that's another way that the two of you can remain happily together.
Good.
In health and in money.
Oh, okay.
Thanks, William. Thank you so much for joining us. If you have a question you want to answer it on air or online, head over to marketplacemoney.org. So many of us were taught our first financial lessons at home from our families. But now 39 states have financial curriculum standards in their schools. Now that means there's a new teacher in town. And we even have an official financial literacy month. And I think we can all agree that we need to know more about how to manage our money, or you wouldn't be listening to me and I wouldn't have this career. But there's a lot of debate on just how much value there is in actual financial education. And we like to hear on this show all sides of the story. So we have a segment devoted to these discussions. This is Financial Feud. Joining us is Helene Olin and Dan Kadlik. Helene is a Reuters contributor and author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. Welcome, Helene.
Thank you.
And Dan is a longtime contributor to Time magazine, and his latest book is A New Purpose, Redefining Money, Family, Work, Retirement, and Success. Hello, Dan.
Happy to be here.
Helene, you don't mince any words when it comes to this topic at all. In a blog that you wrote, I'm going to quote you here, "Financial literacy is a bunch of hooey."
I always say coming out against financial literacy felt like coming out against apple pie. What on earth could be wrong with learning about your finances, right? But in fact, what I discovered when I looked at it very carefully, that financial literacy had simply become a very personal way of attempting to solve what is essentially an economic and political problem, which is that the financial marketplace has become extremely complicated in the past 30, 40 years. And at the same time, our ability to keep up financially has fallen behind with income stagnation, income inequality. It's a recipe for disaster.
So, Dan, what about that, the knowledge level? Because there is so much that we have to know, and it does seem like we have to get so sophisticated. What is that relationship between the knowledge and decision-making that we make with our money?
It's a difficult subject, and it's difficult to learn, and it's difficult to translate knowledge into behavior change. It's a fairly new effort. Financial literacy, the term itself, is only 20 years old. Financial education, the thought of it in schools, is probably only 10 years old, and it never really caught wind until the recession. We need to teach kids from K through 12 in a systematic way, like math or English.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned the recession that this became popular. You know, there's a lot of financial product out there that a lot of people just didn't understand. So for you, financial literacy is something that can help folks understand the industry and the products.
Yes, but financial literacy isn't how to buy a super beta fund. You know, financial literacy is defining wants versus needs and income versus expenses.
Helene, is there anyone doing it right?
I think these efforts are helpful, but I think they miss the bigger point. And the bigger point is this. We've been thrown out there really almost defenseless. And we're being told you can master all of this. And some people can, but many can't. And many can't because of things that are not their fault. To me, discussing financial literacy without discussing the financial structure around us is like taking a house that has been damaged in an earthquake, not looking at the foundation and putting a new hardwood floor in and thinking it's all going to be okay. We really need to look at the structure of our financial world and ask why so many people are so defenseless.
Well, that's why I think we need to get something that is vetted and is in the schools. You know, an interesting point to me is we teach kids literature, but we don't expect them to be great writers. We teach them math, but we don't expect them all to be engineers. People can do with this knowledge what they want, but we have to build a base and give them that information. I don't understand why we need this high bar for financial literacy. Why do we need proof positive that it's going to lead to behavior change? That doesn't exist in any other sphere. And yet we have this whole different mindset on financial literacy, which doesn't make any sense to me.
We have this idea, those of us who like financial stuff, that if we should just expose other people to it, they'll understand it to some extent. It's sort of like being a trade aficionado and starting to talk about trades and then expecting people to just enjoy your love of trades. It doesn't really practically work. Some people will pick up on it, but a lot won't. So it's simply not a full-on solution. The other point is that a lot of financial literacy has been used post the recession. There is a reason it has come up so much post the 2008 crash. It's because it has been used by the financial sector to say, hey, wait a minute. It wasn't really our fault. What were you doing signing that mortgage for the house you couldn't afford? What were you doing taking out an adjustable rate mortgage? Why were you living beyond your means? You really should have thought about the fact you might lose your job.
You should have read that contract, right, that I gave you to sign. And I equate it to like the doctor-patient relationship, right? Is that if you're with a bank on the other side of the table, you know, and a doctor says, here's your prescription, take that and fill that out. The same thing happened a lot in the housing, you know, crisis. Right. Or folks said, here's the mortgage you can afford, and people signed. So there is this lack of balance of information and knowledge. Dan, what do you think that we can do, not just when it comes to the schools, when it comes to adults, when it comes to just getting some of this out? Because you really believe that information can give people more tools to make better decisions.
Right, but I think it's a long-term solution. In the near term, we can erect safeguards, and the CFPB is doing some of that. But long term, I think people need to be able to fend for themselves. You know, this notion of just-in-time education, it sounds nice, but it's really more problematic than teaching financial education. The time to learn about mortgages isn't when you're sitting down to sign the document. That would be just in time. the time is when you start thinking about buying a house so that you know what houses you should even be looking at. What does just-in-time education mean in the context of retirement savings? When you're 65, you're going to tell me about it? No, you need to start saving at 18 and never stop. And that's kind of where people who don't want to teach it in school want to move to this sort of big brother approach, which I think can be helpful, but isn't the answer. So the long-term solution, starting in kindergarten, make it mandatory through 12th grade, teach it either as part of other courses or as a standalone course, but teach it every year and build year after year as you do with any other subject.
Dan, you mentioned a really good point. Constantly people come to me and say, I just don't know where to go. And it's funny because they're not going to say, okay, well, besides our books, where do you go for trusted information, especially different ages too? Because we're not just talking about school age kids. We're talking all the way to adults and beyond.
The easy answer to that is there is this website, mymoney.gov. It's built by Treasury and it's got a lot of information. So there's a start.
Helene, what about you? Somebody comes up to me and just says, where do I go?
I beg people to get old-fashioned and go back to the newspaper, the impartial newspaper. The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal both have terrific personal finance columnists and so on. I try to steer people towards very impartial sources.
And you know what I say to folks? Go to marketplacemoney.org.
I should have
Carmen
said that.
Question. That's my job. Thank you guys so much for joining us. Dan Kadlec, a contributor to Time Magazine, and Helene Olin is a contributor to Reuters. Dan and Helene, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Anytime.
So as you settle down post-Turkey, ask yourself this question. How much did your upbringing hold influence over how you spend money this time of year? Each week, we turn the mic over to hear a story about how those moments with your family shape the way you live money. Today, a rock star just says no to a rock star lifestyle.
I'm Greg Graffin. I'm the lead singer of the band Bad Religion, and I split my time between that and lecturing in evolution at Cornell University. I always had this feeling all along that being a punk rock singer was not a legitimate career. And pursuing the much more difficult route to a PhD, that was something that was probably driven from my upbringing in an academic household. My mother was an administrator at a university, and my father was a professor of English. Above the TV, there was bookshelves. And it was not only Winston Churchill's History of the Second World War staring me in the face, but it was the great multi-volume set on Civilization by the Durans. My dad was frugal, and my mom was a little bit the opposite. I was never sat down on his knee and told, here is my secret, son, for how you can live a frugal lifestyle and still get all the things you want. But I will say this, when I was a kid, we never spent money. We spent our time playing pickup basketball, and when we weren't doing that, we were having snowball fights, and there wasn't the consumerism that there is today. It would never have crossed our mind, for instance, to go hang out at the mall. Because I never came from a consumerism background, I don't think I ever bought into the consumerisms of rock starism. You know, I mean, I never purchased fancy sports cars. You know? And so instead, you go and you buy a house a little earlier than your peers. I would say, somewhere between a well-paid professor and a university president in my values.
Mosh Pit fans, get in line. Bad Religion has a new album out of Christmas songs. Send us your own tune of your lessons in family money. Tweet us at Live Money and record your story at marketplacemoney.org.
That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, your financial New Year's resolutions. How to actually make them stick in 2014. Marketplace Money is produced by Dan Gretsch, Nancy Fargali, Raghu Manavalan, Candice Manriquez, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Brendan Willard is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. Remember, always check with your financial pro before you make any big money decisions. Thanks for listening, and let's talk soon. This is APM.